Well, Jesus is getting ready to send his disciples out on a mission. And it doesn't sound very promising. Because a little earlier, he has told them, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Now, how do you think you would respond if I said, okay, we're going on a mission, but you're going to be the sheep, and I'm sending you out among wolves? You'd be pretty excited about that, wouldn't you? Well, Jesus doesn't stop there. He goes on to describe specifically the kinds of things that are going to happen. You're going to be dragged into court. That's right, religious courts and Roman courts, and you're going to have to testify. Don't worry about what you're going to say. You just tell the story of what God has done in your life. That's your witness. That's all you have to do. But believe me, they will drag you into court. You know, it's interesting. You may have heard about some of the church trials that have been going on in the United Methodist Church over the past few months. Most of them about pastors who have presided at same-sex ceremonies, same-sex weddings, and have been charged with that and tried for that. And wherever you stand on that, it seems to me that in this passage and throughout the Gospels, while Jesus warns about what the Romans and those outside of the group of his followers might do to you, I don't think he could ever imagine that his followers would be putting others of his followers on trial, or anybody else for that matter. I think we got that somewhere else. I think maybe we've become the people Jesus warned us about. Anyway, he said it's not going to stop there. They're going to harass you. And that harassment is not going to stop. They're going to hound you. When they do, if they don't hear you, just leave. Just get out of there. Not sounding any more promising, is it? Not at all. Then he goes on to tell them, as we heard today, not to be afraid. Everything that they have heard in the dark, they're to speak in the light. Everything will be revealed. These people who are being awful to them, don't have to worry about them. You don't have to be afraid. It's amazing how Jesus tells these scary stories and then says, don't be afraid. Why should we not be afraid? I would be. But then he goes on to say, do not fear those who can just kill the body. Fear the one who, if he chose to, could send body and soul to hell. That's kind of scary about God, isn't it? Except for the very next thing Jesus says, which is, you know, these sparrows, I mean, you can get them for practically nothing. But to God, you are of more value than many, many sparrows. If God attends to the least sparrow, don't you think God will attend to you? The one who could burn body and soul in hell loves us more than many sparrows, loves us more than we can imagine. So we don't have to be afraid of anything. It's interesting. I can't imagine how these followers of Jesus could have much self-worth left after they go through being charged in court, being dragged into court, being harassed, being criticized. And of course, the worst thing is, Jesus says, you know, a slave isn't above the master, a student isn't above the teacher, but if the teacher is called Beelzebul, the prince of demons, just think what they're going to call you. Demonization kind of flattens everything out, no matter who we demonize, right? And this is literal demonizing. How could they have any kind of self-worth left? Because they know that the one who has power over life and death, this life and the afterlife, loves them more than many, many sparrows. You know, in our culture, we measure self-worth in a lot of different ways. Some people will say, well, yeah, he was worth $20 billion. and we measure it by the accumulated money or the accumulated stuff that an individual has required. The only problem with this is that when you die, those billions don't do you much good. They may do other people good, but they're not going to do you much good. For others of us, we say our worth is measured in the contributions we make to the community. And I think that's true. Last week we mentioned John Siegenthaler. His contributions include the First Amendment Center. There are many institutions in this town that are the legacy of individuals or families. It could be that you measure your worth by your children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren or those you have mentored, whether you have children or not, those whose lives you have touched and helped shape. It could be that you find your worth in the organs that, when they are no longer of use to you, can be used to save someone else's life. So you sign that organ donor card. Or perhaps you donate your body to Vanderbilt. Sometimes you hear about the worth of the human body if it's kind of boiled down to its basic elements, because we're mostly water, I think. We're not worth all that much. Probably the most devastating way that we measure our self-worth is by what other people think about us. And I have to say, this is a particular difficulty for preachers, because we as preachers are people who like to be liked and need to be needed for the most part. And that can be very dangerous, because it can stand in the way of preaching the gospel, because we're afraid somebody won't like us. I've got two examples of how people responded to public opinion. They are people who not only knew each other, but were friends, grew up together. They are people who were both major writers, and yet they responded to the adulation they received from the larger society in radically different ways. One of those is Harper Lee. I've already mentioned to you my admiration for Harper Lee. There's a new book out about her called The Mockingbird Next Door. I received it as a gift from my daughters, and I'm in the midst of reading it. And you may know that the character in To Kill a Mockingbird, Dill, is based upon the young Truman Capote. They were friends. Not only were they childhood friends, but when Capote went to Kansas to research In Cold Blood, Harper Lee went with him and helped research that murder and contributed in ways that we'll never know to the book that resulted from that. But the way they dealt with the public attention and how they allowed it to shape who they were was radically different. Capote loved to be associated with wealthy and powerful people, with celebrities, and he too became a celebrity. Now, you know, sometimes people become a celebrity because they're a celebrity. You know, they're well-known because they're well-known, and for no other particular reason. This is not the case with Capote. He's a very fine writer. If you've ever read any of his early short stories, Children on Their Birthday, Girls in Their Summer Dresses, they're gems. Written in his early 20s, I'm jealous. In Cold Blood, in itself, is a remarkable book. Horrifying and remarkable in many ways. And yet, Capote's need to be a celebrity, to be associated with the wealthy and the powerful and the well-known, ultimately became his downfall. Because by the end of his life, he died addicted and alone, having been deserted by almost all of those famous people that he wanted to be associated with. His writing had gone downhill severely because it appeared that his whole sense of worth came from what other people thought of him. Harper Lee was just the opposite. She wrote To Kill a Mockingbird expecting to have a few tepid reviews and then it would pass out of sight. Well, you know as well as I know, that's not what happened. Not only was it a bestseller, it won the Pulitzer Prize. A movie was made from it. She was associated with famous people, Gregory Peck being one of those, of course. She had the attention of the world, and she backed away from it. Now, there are folks who would say that's because she was shy. Well, in what I've read, she doesn't seem particularly shy. She seems pretty forthright in her opinions. I'm going to speculate and say that I think Harper Lee pulled back, spending half of her time in Monroeville, Alabama, her hometown, and half in New York City, because she didn't want to lose touch with that community that had formed who she was, the community she fictionalized in her novel. She only wrote one. But when you write one like that, you don't need to write anymore. She surrounded herself with her sister, Alice, an attorney who practiced into her 90s, friends from Monroeville, friends from the literary community, but she was never willing to become the celebrity that she could have become. I think in part because she wanted to be the person she was and not have her worth defined by what other people thought. How do we define our worth? It's hard for us to believe in a society that rewards accomplishment, that encourages us to pay great attention to what other people think about us. It's hard for us to think that our worth is a given. It's already there. When we are born, God loves us more than many sparrows, more than anything we could imagine. The one who holds life and death, now and eternity, decided to love us before we ever even appeared. We are God's beloved children, and we don't have to do anything to earn that. We don't have to do anything to deserve that. We couldn't. It's a gift. It's God's grace. And so no matter how our society chooses to say we're worthy or not worthy, we know where our worth comes from. We know who has called us beloved. We know that our worth is not anything that we do. It's not how much people like us or need us. It's not our status in the world at all. It is the fact that God's love frees us to be our true self. Not the public self we create. T.S. Eliot called it in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, the face to meet the faces that we meet, that public face we create. It's not that. It's the self that only God can see. And God sees the good and the bad. God sees the mistakes and the triumphs and loves us anyway, beyond our imagining. If we have worth at all, that's where it comes from. And since God is faithful, we do have worth more than many, many sparrows.